Hello and welcome to Swiss Info's program for March 29th. I'm Jessica Dacey in Bern. It's the most secretive country in the world. Getting in is complicated. It takes some maneuvering and you absolutely have to follow the rules. Getting out is only a dream for many.
I expected it to be part Disneyland and part, you know, Aspen, I guess, or something.
In the program, we'll be looking at North Korea through the eyes of a journalist and a photographer who went there, of all things, to ski. We'll also be hearing from people who managed to escape. One, a prison camp survivor.
My mother and older brother were publicly executed.
Another, a pianist who was playing the wrong kind of music. Journalist and travel writer Tim Neville doesn't spend much time at his home in Oregon. He's written about places all over the world, but North Korea was something different. He was given permission to visit a new ski resort that opened in January. But you don't go to North Korea and not want to write about the story behind the story. I spoke to him on his return. So Tim, was it hard as a travel writer to get into North Korea?
The surprising thing about going to North Korea, especially as an American, is how easy it is to actually go. One of the first questions that people always asked when I told them that I was going to North Korea was, wait, you can go to North Korea? And the answer is absolutely. It's not routine. It's not just like showing up in Zurich and then walking around and finding something to do. It's very controlled. You have to have a guide, and oftentimes it's usually two guides because the guides also watch each other.
So how much of the real North Korea did you see?
That's a good question. And the answer is I don't know. And that is the problem, I think, when you travel there. And the thing that sort of weighed on me heavily during this whole trip was that you can't really be sure what is real and what's being staged, what's being shown to you, you know, as in an effort to sort of impress and to show that things are good. You know, Pyongyang, for instance, is, you know, the capital. It's kind of like the Hunger Games in the capital. It's like everybody wants to be there. It's the place that has all the money, all the electricity, you know, cars, watches. And so not anybody can just live in Pyongyang. You have to have a spotless ideological record. You have to come from a family that is not considered hostile to the regime. You know, you're sort of the chosen people if you live in Pyongyang. And that's where a lot of the tourists go. So just by virtue of being in Pyongyang, you know, you're seeing what they kind of want you to see. And then when you're traveling across the countryside, of course, you know, you're seeing glimpses of the real North Korea. You're seeing, you know, the country people carrying enormous piles of wood to heat their homes and to cook. You're seeing the army out doing anything from building roads to training to, you know, drying rice or corn.
And the main purpose of your trip really was to visit this new ski resort that opened in the start of this year. You've skied all over the world. And how did these North Korean slopes match up then?
You know, yeah, I have skied all over the world. And I've skied even in Asia a little bit. And I really went there not expecting much. I expected it to be part Disneyland and part, you know, Aspen, I guess, or something. I really had no idea of how in the world they were going to pull this off. So imagine my surprise when I get there and this hotel that they've built, you know, this two-part hotel is just immaculate. It's got these beautiful stone tile floors, elegant woodwork, you know, exquisite lighting. Everybody's super friendly. They serve great food, you know, and then the actual skiing itself was surprisingly great. It's very well built. The runs are all north facing. They have great fall lines. It's absolutely a beautiful area. Lots of birch trees and total wilderness. But from what I understand, also a lot of North Koreans will never actually have to pay to go there. They'll join certain clubs. You know, their work unit may be rewarded for meeting certain quotas. It'll be a perk. So it is in some ways definitely for, you know, those in North Korea who are playing the game, who support the regime, who are being rewarded in some way.
now you're home, and you've seen, I know, the latest UN report on the actual human rights abuses that have been taking place in North Korea. What light does all that shed on your trip?
It was no secret that very awful stuff is happening there, which makes going there all the stranger, because they do this really good job of showing you sort of socialism successes. They show you masses of people working together for the benefit of the collective over the individual. You know, they show you these beautiful ceremonies. Well, and then you go to something as random as a water park, or you go skiing, and you get this very real sense of normalcy, like, oh, life here must not be that bad, when in the back of your mind, you know it's probably the worst place on earth.
Swiss-based photographer Dan Patitucci was also on the trip, taking photos for Tim's pieces. I put it to him that if you're going to the most secretive country in the world, you must want to photograph everything.
I've never wanted to shoot so much in my life. Like, it was nonstop visual, just a mecca of visuals. But you can't shoot. You're not allowed. And you couldn't do anything. And technically, we weren't supposed to be doing what we were doing there. We are journalists. We are working in the media. So there was this constant level of fear.
Just how much control would they be under? They found out as soon as they arrived. On the bus from the airport to Pyongyang, they were given a talk and all the rules were spelled out, one by one.
You couldn't shoot the people unless you had permission. You were only supposed to shoot out the bus window if it was of quote-unquote pretty things. They didn't want you to show poverty or old infrastructure or anything that could be an embarrassment or used against them by the West. And we had had a briefing in Beijing before from the Western guides, from the tour service we went, and thank God we did, because they really cleared it up for us as to how to handle these situations. Don't break the rules, because not only can you get in trouble, but the guides can get into a lot of trouble, which was an interesting thing.
As a photographer, he was quick to notice the symbols of propaganda everywhere. The screen monitors blaring socialist slogans day and night. The pictures in the classrooms of nuclear weapons, but especially the statues.
Statues everywhere. Statues of the strong North Korean soldier. Of course, statues of their great leaders. Kim Jong Il, Kim Il-sung, statues all over the place. And every time you were able to go see them and photograph them, they would actually check to make sure that you were photographing them head to toe. You had to show them full frame. You couldn't cut them off. If you took a picture of one of their photos, there could be no reflection on the photo. Their pictures are on the cover of the newspaper every day. And you're not allowed to fold the newspapers across their image. You're not allowed to set anything on the newspaper, like a coffee cup that might leave a ring on it. You're not allowed to throw them away. Their images are protected and their images are everywhere. A British tourist described it as a necrocracy, that it's the only country in the world being run by dead people.
And you can see Tim Neville's story and Dan Patitucci's photos at swissinfo.ch. Tim and Dan's trip coincided with the release of a groundbreaking UN report into the dark underbelly of life in North Korea. Over 300 people were interviewed over the course of a year about life there. They told of abductions, mass starvation, brainwashing, and they talked of life inside the country's notorious political prison camps, where up to 120,000 people are currently detained without trial. Inside the camps, there are executions, rape, torture. Mothers are forced to kill their newborn babies. For one member of the UN Commission who oversaw the report, it was the worst thing he had ever heard of.
Although I had myself in my own country been a judge for 34 years when I took on this task, nothing in my previous life had really prepared me for the kind of evidence which we three commissioners heard.
The commission doesn't just want the report to end up on a shelf, though.
And I believe the report will be published by a commercial publishing house. I hope it will be published in a paperback. and I hope it will become a bestseller.
In a vote on March 27th in Geneva, the UN Human Rights Council adopted the report and called for it to be submitted to the UN Security Council, with a view to holding accountable those responsible for the killings, abductions, and torture in the country. Adequate international measures should also be taken, the Council said. North Korea categorically rejected the resolution. Its ambassador to the Council told delegates to mind their own business. In Geneva, to tell his story, was Shin Dong-hwik, the only known escapee from what is a total control zone inside North Korea.
I was born in political prison camp number 14, which is in the South Pyongyang province. Where I lived, only two kinds of people existed: the guards who had guns and the people who are inmates wearing uniforms. On April 5th, 1996, I got permission to visit my house within the camp. My older brother was also there. In the room, my mother and brother were talking in the corner. I overheard their conversation. I think they were planning to escape. I went to the school and reported their conversation to my teacher. On the morning of April 6th, guards came to get me. In front of all the inmates, political prisoners, and in front of my father and myself, my mother and older brother were publicly executed. I was obliged to report every detail to the guards. That was the rule of the prison camp. So that's obviously why I thought it was my job to report their plan to the guard at the time. I went to the supervisor and asked him to reward me, to give me my full portion of cooked, dried rice to fill my stomach. I'd been promised that reward, and that's why I reported their plan. The next morning, the guards took me away. I was put in a prison. They tortured me. I couldn't move afterwards. I was taken to another cell. I don't remember for how long, but it was about 6 months.
After 24 years in the camp, Shin managed to escape. He now travels telling his story and was on hand to promote the UN report.
I really hope this Commission of Inquiry report will not be forgotten, that it will not be considered just another report. Hundreds of thousands of people's lives depend on it.
Another person to escape North Korea and who hopes to make a difference in his homeland is pianist Kim Jul-wong. A musician, he felt it was time to go when he got into trouble for playing a piece of music by the French pianist Richard Clayderman. Western music like this is banned.
I think everybody has the right to express one's emotions, and the fact that I could not do so through my music really frustrated me a lot, frustrated me to the extent that I wanted to escape the country and find myself in a new world.
He was also inspired to write a piece about unity between North and South Korea.
You know that North and South Korea do not have much in common, but this is one song, Arirang, that the both Koreas share together. And I thought that this is a good piece, looking forward to our relations between the two Koreas. And also, I edited the music so that I put my hope that the North Korean human rights situation will improve in the future. So I guess I put all the emotions there, and that's where you get all the, powerful power in the music.
Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week. I'm Jessica Dacey.